Welcome, Paul. Paul is on.
Great.
Morning, everyone.
All right. Let's get the show on the road then. Okay. I'd like to welcome you all to the Board of Directors meeting for Altus Schools Southern California Nonprofit Board, which also operates Audeo Charter School 2, Audeo Charter School 3, Audeo Valley Charter School, Grossmont Secondary, Miras Secondary, and Sweetwater Secondary. I'm Waylon Myers, Chairman of the Board, and I'll facilitate the meeting. Let's take the roll first. When I call your name, please provide the group with a brief introduction for the benefit of new members and members of the public. Chris Gordon.
Chris Gordon, founder and president of Greet Three Gifts, present. Thank
Great.
You.
Jim Herr.
Jim Herr, president of Perrin Hall, present.
And Christina Stevens is absent. Adam Waylon Myers, chairman of the board. I'm the CEO of Myers Media Group, and I'm obviously present. Mary, do you want to introduce anyone else present at the meeting? You already introduced Paul. We have Kayla as well. Anybody else? Okay, sounds good.
Yeah.
All right, so quorum has been established. Do I have a motion for approval of item 1.3? And maybe since there's two of you, you just go back and forth.
This is Jim Herr, and I make a motion to approve item 1.3.
May I have a second?
Chris Gordon, I second.
All right, let's conduct the vote via roll call. Chris Gordon, your vote.
Chris Gordon, aye.
Jim Herr, your vote.
Jim Herr, aye.
And Waylon Myers votes aye. That one passes. Section 1.4, let's do the Pledge of Allegiance. Please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. Ready? Begin. I pledge allegiance,
to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God,
indivisible,
with liberty and justice for all.
That fixed up again here. All right, excellent. Moving on to the approval of the agenda. Item 1.5, approval of agenda. Do I have a motion for approval with a recommendation from Mary Bixby? That'd be Chris, your turn to motion.
A motion to approve the agenda.
Okay, sounds good. And may I have a second for that?
Jim Herr and I second that motion.
Excellent. Let's take our vote via roll call. All those in favor say aye, no, or abstain. Chris Gordon, your vote.
Chris Gordon, aye.
Jim Herr?
Jim Herr, aye.
And Waylon Myers votes aye as well. Section 2.0, public comment. Public comment for items of interest to the public and within the scope of the Altus Schools Southern California Board non-agenda shall be no longer than 2 minutes. Public comment for agenda items shall be no longer than 3 minutes. Speakers may not yield their time. In meetings held over Zoom, any person who wishes to make a comment on either a non-agenda or agenda item shall use the raised hand feature of Zoom to notify the board. In accordance with the Brown Act, no discussion or action may occur at this time, but it is the board's prerogative to respond or give direction to staff. All public comment will be heard at this point in the agenda as ordered below. Each agenda item being commented on will have a maximum of 20 minutes allotted, and each non-agenda item will have a maximum of 10 minutes allotted. If necessary, the board chair may equivalently decrease the time for each speaker in order to stay within the allotted maximum. Section 2.1, the non-agenda public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items not on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Actually, I think that's actually 2 minutes, not 3 minutes. Are there any public comments on items not on the agenda? I do not see any raised hand thing. Moving on. Section 2.2, items, agenda items, public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items that appear on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Are there any public comments on agenda items? I don't see any raised hands, so moving on. Section 3.0, part 2, board workshop and training. Young, Mini, and Coor Law Firm will provide comprehensive professional development training to the board on best practices in charter schools, board management, including fiduciary duties, fiscal oversight, the Brown Act and conflict of interest laws, and critical case updates and new laws affecting charter schools. So Paul, Mini of Young, Mini, and Coor will be conducting part two of the board workshop training. I will turn it over to you.
Good morning. Thank you, Board Chair. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
As you noted, my other colleague here is Kayla Haydu. She's the one who conducted the Brown Act and conflict of interest training, and she will take the second part of today's training to discuss and review the new laws and new court cases, of which there are many. Let me just take one step back, though, and just cover something we talked about last time about the Brown Act. And I know the state's laws that changed around the issue of, and use of telephony to hold board meetings like we're doing here today are extremely convoluted and difficult to understand. But the good news is, for purposes of meeting in the format like we are today, using video and Zoom, et cetera, was that the pre-pandemic laws did not change. And the ability to hold a meeting virtually like we're doing, which many organizations are still doing, still exists if we follow the old rules. The old rules were, I think, fairly straightforward. It just meant that the agenda must locate and must identify every teleconference location on it. And so everybody participating remotely would be able to identify where they could go. All those locations have to be open to the public. All votes have to be taken by roll call, and a majority of the board members have to be located in the county. San Diego County, or the county in which, I didn't check the bylaws for Alta School Southern California, but I know at least for Alta School San Diego, it's San Diego County. Correct me if I'm wrong, Tim or Lynn or Mary on Alta School Southern California, but the bylaws allow for that and specifically continue to allow for that. So that's the, I just recommend our clients for the most part ignore a lot of the other changes. And if they're going to hold the meetings using teleconference locations, that they just do it under the old rules, which are fairly straightforward. So I just thought I would mention that before we start, because I know there were a lot of new law changes in that regard. All right, so today there's two parts. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the roles and responsibilities and effective board governance. And then Kayla's going to talk to you about new laws and court cases that have changed. So Kayla's got control of the slides, so I'll just ask her to change to the next slide. So that is that a little fuzzy to you all? Because that's a little fuzzy to me. Is that just me on my end?
No, it's fuzzy. I mean, it's readable, but it's definitely looks
yeah, like I'll tell you what, Kayla, res. Let me grab the slides and do it on my end.
Some reason do you guys I'm... give Kayla like a really old computer? Or what's up?
No.
Poor Kayla.
It's I'll tell you what, if you stop screen sharing, I'll open it on my end. It did look like that, though, didn't it? It looked like a some reason it had the...
Yeah, it was like 1024 by 768 or something.
she's not going to get... She just said that her internet provider increased their rates, and so I think she's now going to get really upset with somebody. All right, let me we can share from here. Let me know.
I swear AT&T called me like 2 weeks ago and asked me if I wanted my program expanded. And I said, no, the day after my internet went down in the tubes. Totally punished me. I'm sure of it.
All right. So are we seeing this now?
Much better.
Okay, good. All right. So this is a distillation of the top 10 things that our firm, which has been, I've been doing this for 30 years now, 30 years this month, actually. I was saying in the last board meeting, I got my bar results 30 years ago. And by January, I was already working on the fifth charter in the state of California. So the Charter Schools Act is 30 years old, 1993 to 2023. And we've looked back, and the lawyers and the partners, and we've worked with outside organizations like Brian Carpenter that have studied why charter schools fail. And so we've compiled this list, what excellent high-performing charter school boards do. Obviously, it's a compilation of those that things that they do well and avoiding those things that allow that essentially form the basis of charter school failure. I'll cover this top 10 list, and then a lot of the slides that follow dive a little deeper into these things. But The primary thing that effective boards do is they understand the board roles and responsibilities and how they differ from the administration's roles and responsibilities. We'll cover that on the other slides. They also understand that they govern, they don't manage. We'll go through that a little later. And they contribute to a positive school culture, both in the way they interact with each other, the way they interact with staff, the way they interact with members of the public and other people that they see outside the organization. They speak with one voice. So they understand the will of the majority and the way democratic principles work, and the bylaws allow for a majority of people on the board to make a decision. And if they were in a minority role or vote on things, they still support the majority decision. And that's speaking with one voice, and that they understand that in the long run, that's best for the organization. They maintain their multiple fiduciary duties, which we'll cover: duty of loyalty, duty of inquiry, duty of care. And they respond appropriately to complaints, which sounds unusual, but it is really true that as board, and maybe not so much because your organization is so well organized and run so effectively over so many years, but many of our clients, the parents, teachers, sometimes they try to bypass the administration and they complain to the board members. And effective boards reroute those complaints back to the administration for resolution. They don't become the, if they start trying to fix things at the complaint level, they start managing for one, which is breaches some of the things we're talking about. And they also become a complaint center, because the minute you start trying to fix one thing, you're going to see other complaints come to you. They regularly educate themselves, like you're doing today. They engage in professional development. They attend conferences. They conduct internal professional development and trainings like you all have been doing. And then key is that they monitor student performance, finances, legal, and safety. Those are the primary four big buckets that board members and the board as a whole at a high level, the 10,000 foot level, monitor, because the school performance and finances are the two biggest issues, right? School performance is what the compact is, what we have with our granting agencies to achieve academic performance. Finances and maintaining fiscal solvency is critical. Fiscal solvency and insolvency and mismanagement is one of the primary reasons charter schools fail. And then legal and safety, legal compliance, making sure the board is both compliant with the law and that it sets proper guardrails for the organization to operate through policies, and safety, monitoring the safety of resource centers, buildings, staff, work environments, et cetera, and properly insuring against risk. And then the key is that the board evaluates the primary school leader and holds him or her responsible and accountable for achieving the long-term goals of the organization. And then the board, lastly, effective boards regularly engage in strategic planning. So they're looking ahead and they're assessing those things that they're doing well, things that they could do better, and areas, their long-term and short-term goals over a number of years. Anyway, if we could flip on to the next screen, building on the, I was telling Kayla to do it. I forgot I took control myself. I was like, come on. Building on that, defining the roles and responsibilities and understanding that division is, here's just a chart that it outlines some board duties at a high level and the school leader's duties at a high level, just to sort of elaborate further on understanding that a role between governing and managing. The board, its primary function on the personnel side is to hire, supervise, evaluate the primary leader. A lot of charter schools use executive director, some use CEO, president, superintendent, whoever that primary school leader is. You approve and monitor and implement the policies, which are the guardrails for the organization, and generally are affectation of the laws that are the school must operate within. You approve and monitor the charter school's annual budget and budget revisions and watch the fiscal solvency of the organization. You hire an external auditor to audit and make sure everything is running smoothly. You measure student progress. You engage in that strategic planning and set things at a broad level like the school calendar. The school leader, on the other hand, the primary leader is the one who usually supervises, evaluates, and hires the other administrators, teachers, and staff, oversees the finances and the expenditures on a day-to-day basis consistent with the budget, monitors and maintains school's compliance and works with legal counsel, takes responsibility for maintaining high levels of school attendance, identifying future staff needs, producing, you know, the big reports to the state on academic performance, SARC and LCAP, et cetera. And also all the last one here is all sort of the nitty gritty stuff, maintaining privacy and confidentiality of student records, teacher records, and academic information, et cetera. So again, I'm going to say that these two organizations, Alta School Southern California and San Diego, are successful, long-running, you know, well-heeled, well-organized, well-oiled engines. This is not new to you, and you're doing this. So don't think as we're talking about it today, we're trying to tell the board to do something differently. It's more like continue to do what you're doing. But the board's function, focusing on the third bullet here, is to focus on how well the organization is achieving its goals, not how will. How well gets into the governance, how will gets into the management. And you can take the first bullet. If you looked at a professional, you know, sports team or franchise, you think about the team owner as the board and the coach as the executive director. You know, the team owner is the one who sets the long-term goals, hires the coach and says, look, win the Super Bowl or go back to the Premier League or whatever we're talking about, you know, achieve certain levels of goals. And then it's the coach that hires the players, recruits the talent, evaluates the talent, and does the how will, the all the administrative implementation of it to try to achieve those goals. And then the team owner or the board here holds that executive director accountable for trying to achieve those goals. Board, as I said, sets the goals and policies, the guardrails in which the coach do, you know, is to operate within. And then the board sits back and doesn't try to manage or implement day-to-day decisions. They don't direct individuals. And again, they're not responding to individual complaints. Board member liability, well, first of all, board member compliance with the law occurs through maintaining your fiduciary duties, but it also if you maintain your fiduciary duties, you also better protect yourselves as individuals being on a board of a public, more or less what is a public agency running public schools. To do that, you need to meet your fiduciary duty. Fiduciary duty is an obligation for somebody to act in the best interest of another party, not yourself. So the directors, as you are all directors of a nonprofit public benefit corporation, you have fiduciary duty to the nonprofit and to the schools that the schools operate, as well as to the public and community in which you serve. The duty of care is one prong of those fiduciary duties. And the corporations code, which is applicable to nonprofits, defines this, as we know also through common law, as saying a director shall perform their duties in good faith and in a way that they believe to be in the best interest of the corporation and with such care as an ordinarily prudent person would in a like circumstance. And so this gets into that strange world, that legal world of the reasonable person standard, which is what would a reasonable person do when faced with that decision or that contract or that action? And what does a person need to do, understand, and educate themselves to make the best decision on behalf of the corporation, not yourselves, not your own businesses, not your personal beliefs or politics, but on behalf of the corporation and the students you serve. So generally, acting with care meeting that fiduciary duty of care is acting with skill, care, prudence, and diligence, understanding the circumstances, educating yourself to be able to make informed decisions, as we say, having familiarity with the matters, considering the background and experience of both yourselves, what you know and what you bring to the table, but also what you need by way of further education to be able to make informed decisions. The way you stay informed, obviously, is by seeking clarity before you vote, listening to all perspectives and testing your understanding, owning your own decision, meaning you've done the research and you can defend your position on these things. And of course, you effectuate your day-to-day duty of care by not getting involved in the day-to-day business operations of the school. Examples of exercising your duty of care would mean, you know, carefully considering a contract. Is it necessary? Are the risks adequately covered? Has legal reviewed it? Is it reasonably priced? Reading the charter school's financial documents, obviously boards that rubber stamp their administrative agency's actions could possibly breach their fiduciary duty. And I say could because if the administration is one like yours, where you got someone like, you know, Lynn preparing your financials and Mary reviewing the financials, who have been with the organization for, you know, and been in the charter schools movement and has the background expertise that they have, you're allowed to have high levels of confidence in those reports that are coming to you. Now, if a report was produced, if, let's put it this way, if I produced your financial reports, you'd want to ask a lot of questions, because that's not my area of expertise. Never ask your lawyer to balance your budget. Asking questions of staff when you have, you know, complex financial matters and other matters before you is also maintaining your duty of loyalty, duty of care. Part of your duty of care is that duty of inquiry, right? Can't close your eyes. If something comes up that's a red flag, if there's a question or a concern, if you heard something, read something, whatever, as they say, if you think, you know, if you, what is it? See something, say something, I think is the expression for TSA. Same thing for here, meeting your duty of care. Now, duty of loyalty, again, another prong of the fiduciary duty, is always to act in the best interest of the corporation. You all bring your own personal, financial, political perspective, which is enriches the organization. But when it comes to acting and deciding, you have to be able to think, what is in the best interest of the corporation? What is in the best interest of the schools that we're serving? And you have to avoid any split loyalties and make decisions in the best interest of the corporation, not your own financial, personal, or business, or a friend's or constituents' financial interest. And you learned last time, or you heard again, I should say, that the financial conflicts of interest laws are many. We have the conflicts of interest code that you have, filling out Form 700s to make sure you're declaring any places you have financial connections to the organization of the school's activities. Government Code 1090, preventing the board entering into contracts in which anyone or more of the members or administration have a financial interest. Political Reform Act broadens that, but, you know, it says real estate, business positions, other gifts, et cetera, could all create financial conflicts. Corporations Code builds on that with anti-self-dealing provisions. And common law goes even a step further and says you have to avoid conflicts even if they're not financial. So if this is your son's teacher that we're talking about disciplining or removing from the classroom, you may want to bow out of that decision because you are emotionally interested in that position. So you maintain your duty of loyalty by maintaining your avoiding conflicts of interest. Another example would be, you know, duty of loyalty is an example. If you went to a conference and you learned about a great new potential business venture that would benefit the organization, but you took it for yourself and you turned it into a financial, you know, something that benefited you, you're breaching your duty of loyalty. The duty of loyalty would say, if you were at that conference by way of and on behalf of the corporation, that information you learn that could be a benefit has to come back to the corporation. So the principle is simple. You know, you should be free from, I apologize, I thought I had turned these pop-ups off. I don't know if they're popping up on your end, but let me turn this off here.
No, we don't see that. Okay, no, you're good.
Yeah. Maintaining your conflicts of interest by avoiding participating actions in which you're disqualified from participating. The other good news is, though, on the duty of inquiry part, is you get to rely upon the experts and the people around you. So you're entitled to meet your duty of care by relying upon one or more officers or employees that you believe are reliable and competent, as I was saying earlier about your executive team, your outside legal counsel, independent accountants, people that are experts, et cetera. And the code goes even as far as to say, if you've got a committee of the board, which you're not on, that you believe are merit confidence and they've brought you back something to take action on, you can rely upon that committee's advice as well without breaching your duty of care to the organization. Now, the reason, as I said earlier, fiduciary duties are important is because if you perform your duties of a director in accordance with the fiduciary duties we've outlined, duty of care, inquiry, and loyalty, you're not going to be liable. And that will, as another slide, you'll see there's a volunteer provision that says, as long as you're a volunteer board member and meeting your fiduciary duties, you're not liable for the debts and obligations of the organization. Now, all of the independent charter schools like yours are run by nonprofit corporations. And keep that in mind when we get to the slides that Kayla will be going over. That's a very interesting and very bizarre mix of private sector concepts of nonprofits into the world of public charter school operation. And you'll see that play out. But it's important here because we have corporate duties and we have school duties as well. You're responsible for maintaining the oversight of the entire organization. But you're ultimately responsible for how well the schools are doing and how they are financially succeeding, hopefully. And you monitor their performance through the data that you get back from the administrative team. And again, you hold the CEO accountable for achieving both academic performance, fiscal solvency, legal compliance, et cetera. This chart is just a graphical representation, typically, of the level of board involvement, which dips off as the decision-making goes away. So your highest level of board involvement on the personnel side, for example, is hiring the CEO. This chart probably should drop off a little faster because the way your organization operates, some organizations, the board hires the CEO and the CFO, and that's so this chart would be accurate. But here, the board hires the CEO and the remainder of the operational policies and the other managers are hired by the CEO, and that correlates with the level of board oversight day-to-day on those matters. Again, good news, 30 years of working with California nonprofits and charter schools, no board member has yet been liable personally for the debts and obligations of a charter school. And again, and that's in large part because of the protections in law, but also because board members are exercising their fiduciary duties. There are some areas where you have to exercise a higher level of care around tax-exempt bond financing. But lastly, if there is a lawsuit, as there always are, and unfortunately these days, you are named in a lawsuit, the school carries high levels of insurance, including directors and officers insurance, which in general liability insurance, employment practices insurance, et cetera, will step in and defend you against those claims. And in most cases, we quickly get the board members out of those lawsuits, because they're not personally involved. So you avoid entangling yourself with the school's operations in a way that creates personal liability by avoiding acting outside the course and scope of your duties. Obviously, trying to manage rank and file employees. We've had board members come down to certain charter school sites and say, I want a copy of this personnel file, or I want a copy of this student's records. And again, that's not governing as a body. That's not speaking with one voice. That's stepping into the role of an individual, and you're exposing yourself to liability at that point. You might be breaching your duty of care or loyalty, avoiding conflicts of interest, and of course, purposely trying to violate the law, which could all expose you individually to liability. Not that anybody would, but if you tried to call a board meeting for a Saturday morning and you didn't post the agenda knowingly, that would be one area where you could be found to engage in intentional misconduct. We have these slides on duty of financial oversight because it's worth noting that the number one failure point for charter schools across the nation has been fiscal malfeasance and just upside down budgets at the end of the day. And so your budget process year over year is a critical one, which the board is directly involved in and monitors. You have to be able to understand the documents and materials that are before you, whether it's budgets, balance sheets, cash flow, et cetera. Public school finance is extraordinarily complex and very, very different than most any other public agency financing, including obviously the way for-profits and private agencies work. So I know that over the years, there's been just, education and especially as new board members come on how this works in the public school world. As we said, we're emphasizing this because of the importance of it and because authorizers and your county office of education also have a role in monitoring the fiscal oversight of your organization and can ask for records and get interim financial reports and budgets and other financial records. So you have the county, the school district, and your board, hopefully, all watching what's going on so we avoid issues and concerns. And then the adoption of fiscal policies, fiscal control policies, which are, again, are those guardrails that organizations have that state that sorry, I got distracted by a tail in front of Myers. Those guardrails that say, you know, who can write checks, you know, what checks and balances you have, you know, how much warrants can be issued with one signature, et cetera, that are usually reviewed by legal counsel and your outside auditor to ensure that best practices are adhered to. So you can be revoked, your schools can be revoked for fiscal mismanagement. And we've seen that happen, unfortunately, repeatedly. Typically, the school is locked into overspending. There's declining enrollment. They've suffered a lawsuit. They've dropped insurance. They have an audit exception they can't afford. And these are all areas where they go upside down and could lead to revocation of the school. So the chartering authority, as I said, is partially responsible along with the board for monitoring the fiscal condition of the school. And they get the periodic reports like you do as well on budget, interim reports, LCAP, et cetera. And then you have to have your annual independent financial audit, which is submitted to those organizations and to the state as well. The audit process is annual, and obviously it validates the school's reported finances. It's not a fraud audit. It doesn't look for fraud. If there were, as I said earlier, under your duty of care, if there were some concern that there was a suspicion of fraud, that you would want to bring in a different outside fiscal expert to look at expenditures if there were concerns of fraud. Boards must approve the audit agreement in the spring, and then typically the audit is finished in the fall and submitted to the state and other local agencies. All right, Caleb, I'm going to turn this over to you to start in on the ever-changing complex body of laws and new cases over the last year and a half that are impacting the way charter schools and public schools and nonprofits that are operating those organizations are operating.
Thanks, Paul. Happy to be back here with you all today. This is our final stretch. It's the new laws and critical case updates. Last year, Paul and I gave you this presentation as well and covered new laws then and critical case updates then. A lot has happened, so we're looking forward to filling you all in. First up is the budget trailer bill. It's part of this year's budget act. We get one or more than one every year. This budget trailer bill was signed at the end of June. And it put into place a spending plan for 23-24 for schools, and then included several additional legislative measures related to education that charter schools are beholden to. So we're going to go over a few of just the most pressing of those. The first is charter term extensions. So as you may recall, during the 21-22 school year, all terms that expired between January 1st, 2022 and June 30th, 2025 were extended by 2 years. So if your charter was set to expire within that range, you got an automatic 2-year addition to your term. This legislative session, terms were further extended for charter schools whose petitions expire between January 1st, 2024, so coming up here just in a couple months, and June 30th, 2027. So we got another year extension. And here's what it means in practical terms. And actually, if we go to the next slide, we've broken it down for the various schools that Alta Schools Southern California serves so that you can see the actual ramifications of those the extensions and when now your renewal will be. We do want to say that the extensions for some schools are good, but we just want to caution that the appeal process takes a long time. Renewals are being contested, and so it could be as long as 15 months. So just getting it in early is still going to be incredibly important in light of the extension. On the topic of appeals, there's some bad news there. As you may recall, 2019, we got AB 1505. That weakened charter appeal laws. It basically expanded the reasons that the district could deny to include the fiscal impact on the district itself. It also changed the standard of review for the state board. So the state board used to, on appeal, charter petitions would come up on appeal. The state board would look at it de novo, just meaning clean slate, and assess whether it should be approved or denied. Now, in 2019, the standard changed to an abuse of discretion standard, a much higher standard, the most differential standard, and that the 2019 legislation additionally removed the state board's authority to actually grant charter schools upon appeal, instead just limiting them to reversing a denial and remanding it back to the local district or authorizer who had denied in the first place. Frustratingly, this year, the legislator made this already high standard of abuse of discretion even more difficult. So previously, you could appeal to the state board if there was a showing of abuse of discretion at either the district or the county level. And now that or is an and. So the petitioner has to show that both the district and the county abuse their discretion in order to appeal. They also added statutory language that abuse of discretion is the most deferential standard. That's already, we already knew that to be the case, but the fact that they codified it, they put it in writing in the statute itself, it's a signal that these appeals are going to be very hard fought. We can no longer count on the state board as a viable path to renewal. So the focus has to be on approval at those lower levels if we want to get, if we want success. All right, next up, a quick note on a lawsuit in this domain, and then I'm actually also going to touch on one that was just filed after these slides were written just a couple of weeks ago. So the first is this one, it's the Napa Unified School District versus CSBA lawsuit against Myokamish Charter School and the State Board. We talked about this just very briefly last year, so this is an update. As we discussed then, during the last renewal cycle, three charter schools were appealed to the State Board. The State Board denied two of them, or denied one, refused to hear one, and then approved the third, Myokamis. The State Board, in making that determination, said that one of those schools had met the standard. They thus reversed the lower denials. They approved the charter on appeal. And in turn, the district and the California School Board Association sued the State Board for that approval. On the eve of the court ruling, right before the court ruling was rendered, this trailer bill came in. And as we just discussed, the trailer bill changed the standard to be even harder. Remember, it requires now abuse of discretion at both the district and county level. Now, that higher standard should not apply to this case. Myokamis was approved by the state board before that higher standard was put into place. However, the lower court ruled against the state board and the charter school, and the case is now stayed pending an appeal. In addition to that, we also have a new case in LA Superior Court. It's not, like I said, it's not on our slides because it was we just filed it a couple of weeks ago after these slides were written. It's on behalf of a charter school operator, Vista, that has six charter schools in LA and Orange counties. It's against the State Board of Education. And what happened there was Vista sought to open another charter school within LAUSD. The district denied, alleging that the school would, and this is statutory language, substantially undermine the district's current services. The charter school in turn demonstrated that that wasn't true. They demonstrated that the impact was exceptionally small. It was 0.026% of the district's students. So to say that a 0.026% would substantially undermine the district's current services was ludicrous. Still, the denial stood. The charter school appealed to the state board ultimately, and the state board affirmed the denial. So the litigation now seeks to compel the state board to rehear, to set aside its original denial and rehear, because although they heard the case in the first instance, they didn't really dig in. They didn't even include language about this substantially undermine issue. They really didn't get into it. They just affirmed the denial. So the new petition that was, like I said, it was just filed a couple weeks ago, is against them, seeking them to compel the setting aside of that denial. In some other bad news, Paul, I don't know if you had a comment.
No, well, I was just going to say we're fighting hard to try to keep the doors open as best we can at the state board level. But you're, obviously the legislature keeps trying to make it harder and harder, and taking one very viable, as you know, because some of the schools you hold were approved by the State Board of Education, off the table for possible future new schools or challenges. And go ahead, Gail, sorry.
All right. The moratorium was extended in more bad news. Previously, there was a moratorium in place that said that we could have no new non-classroom-based schools until January 1st, 2025. That was in the 2021 trailer bill. This year, in this legislative session, this moratorium was further extended to January 1st, 2026. So it was extended out by another year. And as part of that, we also have, as part of the trailer bill, this FICMAT. There's a FICMAT report coming out. FICMAT is the Fiscal Crisis and Management Assistance Team. Statutorily, they are required now to study the processes used to determine funding for non-classroom-based schools. They were already doing that. They were already engaged in a study that has been ongoing. We're expecting that sometime soon, in early 2024. But they actually codified this in law. And frustratingly, the way this statute was written is incredibly biased and antagonistic. It assumes, as you'll see in bold here, it's not only that they study the processes used to determine funding for non-classroom-based schools, but also make recommendations to enhance oversight. That's fine, but also reduce fraud, waste, and abuse. You know, they actually wrote that into the statute, which presupposes that fraud, waste, and abuse are happening in non-classroom-based schools. So it's a frustrating addition, but like I said, we will see in 2024 likely the FICMAT's report on non-classroom-based schools. This session we got a new add-on component to LCFF, the LCFF Equity Multiplier. It basically provides additional funding for schools with a socioeconomic disadvantaged population of more than 70%. But it excluded non-classroom-based schools for eligibility for this additional funding. So we've seen just this continued process of the legislator trying to undermine non-classroom-based schools and, you know, the wide variety of services, et cetera, that they offer. We also have a change to independent study regulations coming. There we have independent studies regulations as is. They're going through amendments. Right now, they're in the rulemaking process. So there was a comment period that was open until August 1st. We have not, you know, we saw the draft that was pre-August 1st, and now they're working on revisions post-August 1st. In the draft itself, there were some concerning areas that didn't really reflect the reality of non-classroom-based schools and what they do and how they serve students. But it suggests a minimum length of time for live interaction. Nowhere in the statute. It also appears to make traditional and course-based independent study interchangeable, which they're not. And then finally, it suggests that schools must maximize a student's learning and mastery without any understanding of what that means. What does that mean to maximize a student's learning and mastery? How is that assessed? That's, you know, and what we've seen so far, that's not addressed. So something to look out for as well. Okay, we are now going to delve into a discussion of the First Amendment, which, as you know, protects freedom of religion, the free exercise of that religion, and free speech. Disputes over religious expression in schools are nothing new. They have been a constant for years. But last year, we got to see the Supreme Court weigh in. So the first case we're going to talk about in this regard is Kennedy versus Bremerton. This was a big case. It made national news. And essentially, what was happening here is a high school football coach at a school district in Washington State had a routine of saying a prayer in midfield following each football game. So the school district officials came and they asked him to either stop the prayers or please conduct them in a less conspicuous place. He refused, and when he refused, they effectively fired him. He sued, and the case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that these post-game prayers were protected by the First Amendment's free speech and free exercise of religion clauses, and that the school district's firing was a violation of the First Amendment. So importantly, the court determined that the practice of kneeling in prayer was private speech. That was part of their holding, part of their rationale for determining the constitutional violation. It was something that just the coach was doing on his own as an individual. It was not government speech. His own individual actions could not be imputed to that of the school district. And so the school district went too far when it effectively fired him for a private action. The court was careful to draw a distinction between a case like this and a case, other cases where the Supreme Court has found prayer between teachers and students to be problematically coercive, because here, unlike there, the prayers for which the coach was disciplined were not recited to a captive audience. Students were not expected to participate in those prayers, although some did. The court felt that he was not requiring students to engage in prayer with him. Thus, it was just his own individual action. He wasn't imputing it on others. So accordingly, in circumstances like that, the Supreme Court said that the Constitution doesn't allow school districts to suppress that sort of religious expression. This decision is likely to have practical consequences for schools and their supervision of teachers and other employees. But it does leave questions unresolved, the biggest of which I think is students, whether this means that students will have greater protection for their own religious expression in schools. So that is something that we should see play out in the years to come. All right, next up is the Carson v. Macon case, another Supreme Court case. This case involved the state of Maine, and Maine has this special state tuition program where they provide funding for families in towns without public high schools. So like a very rural area, a small town, it doesn't have a public high school. If there's a private high school there, then the state can actually provide funding to that private high school in this special particular circumstance. With the caveat that the funding, the money that's provided, cannot be used for religious school. So though it can be private, it can't be religious. The Supreme Court ultimately found that this exclusion of religious schools from the state tuition program violated the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. So this decision, of course, has impacts for states like Maine. There are actually a number of other states that have this sort of special tuition program. But the most important point of this case, as we have written here, is that the dissenters expressed fears that this case could be broadened to lead to state aid for religious themed charter schools. The idea being that if they were fine with sharing resources with private schools generally, you know, that it was just one more step to share resources with religious themed schools as well. To that end, as we have here, in December of 2022, so we're coming up on about a year, the then Oklahoma Attorney General drew nationwide notice when he concluded that the provisions of Oklahoma law requiring charter schools to be non-sectarian, something that we, of course, also have in California, and not affiliated with religious institutions, would likely be struck down by the Supreme Court in light of this decision. And to test that, in June of just this year, a Catholic organization submitted a charter application for a virtual Catholic charter school in Oklahoma. As expected, the organization was sued. Ultimately, the decision expressed a desire to increase parent liberty and parent rights in the education of their children. So it was filed against the school board that had approved that first religious charter school. The charter school, as we have here, was sponsored by the Catholic Church, and the plaintiffs claim that this public funding of religious education violates the Oklahoma Constitution, which requires that education be non-sectarian, and the Charter Schools Act, which requires the same, much like we do here in California. Specifically, the plaintiffs were requesting that the district block the church from operating as a charter school, that the charter school board, it was also blocked from entering into or implementing contracts with the church. And the biggest one was the state funding of the church charter school. The defendant, in turn, asserted the exclusion of religious schools exclusively on the basis of religion, said that they were unconstitutional in violation of the Freedom of Religion Clause. The defendant claims that charter schools are not public schools and therefore not state actors, something that we are going to get into in just a few minutes, or acting with government authority. So, we'll see how this one plays out. Like I said, it was just filed a few months ago. So it's in the early stages of its litigation, but it is certainly an interesting area of the law.
As I recall in the Carson case, the U.S. Supreme Court made quite a distinction with the fact that the tuition funding was given to the parents, and the parents made the decision to fund either a public or a private or a sectarian school. And obviously, here, this is just the state funding a religious charter school. So there's pretty significant factual distinction between this and the Macon case.
Absolutely. Okay, there's also new litigation challenging California's constitutional and statutory prohibitions on religious instructions. So in this case, two non-classroom-based charter schools, along with the superintendent of public instruction and two school districts, are facing legal action. Parents have sued them, claiming that the schools unlawfully denied them the use of state funds to purchase religious materials for their homeschooling programs through these non-classroom-based schools. They took the Carson v. Macon case and asserted that when is a quote, when the government provides a benefit like parent-directed educational funding, it cannot exclude families just because they choose to use that benefit for religious education. So that's what the parents are, attempting to claim. However, there is a vast variety of California law that prohibits a charter school from providing religious or faith-based curriculum. So we have constitutional provisions. It's also in the education code itself. And then the CDE follows these sentiments, saying, pupils cannot use religious materials to complete independent study assignments. As we have here too, no opinion has ever found that a public school's refusal to adopt a religious or faith-based curriculum constitutes a violation of the free exercise clause or of free speech. So we just wanted to put this one out there. It's one to watch. There's likely to be press on this issue. We're representing one of the non-classroom-based defendants in this case. So we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, the politics and sympathy of various non-classroom-based schools in California are kind of all over the map, I think, on this one. But there was, oh, wow, 15, 18 years ago, we defended a charter school who was revoked because they continued to not monitor the curriculum material purchased by parents, and the district claimed and proved over and over again that the charter school allowed parents to buy faith-based curriculum that was funded with public school funds, and so they closed the charter school. So
All right, First Amendment freedom of speech is another case. This time it's actually regarding board members. So here there were two school board members that were using social media, Facebook and Twitter. They were publicly sharing on those forums information about board meetings, open school positions in the administration, various school activities, student activities, things that were happening at the school. They could also post to and moderate the comments that were actually posted on the school's public page, so they had access to that. Two parents were vocal critics of the board. They were post just dozens and dozens of repetitive comments to the board members' social media accounts over mere minutes. I mean, they were really being very antagonistic. Initially, the board members' approach was to hide those comments, delete those comments. They were repetitive. I mean, they were just over and over and over again. Eventually, both board members blocked the parents from their personal social media accounts. So, when you block somebody, they can no longer see your page, they can't comment on your posts. And then they also introduced word filters so that prevented comments from with commonly used words that were being posted. So this effectively prevented any parent with a similar sentiment from commenting because their comments were automatically blocked if they were using one of those trigger words. The parents sued for First Amendment freedom of speech violation. The plaintiffs argued that the school board members were engaging in state action when they were blocking individuals, even off of their personal social media accounts. They were acting in their official capacity as board members. In the use and management of their social media accounts, that was the plaintiff's perspective because they were posting about school ongoings and et cetera. The defendants, in turn, argued that managing their personal social media accounts was not performance of an official duty. They were acting just in this private capacity. They asserted that the use of their social media accounts was primarily to further their political careers, their political aspirations, and therefore, you know, there was really something personal and independent from the school. The Ninth Circuit decided that the nexus between the board members' use of their social media pages and their official positions was close enough to paint them as acting under the color of the law. So they found that blocking the comments was unconstitutional because they were acting in a school official capacity. The case was appealed from the Ninth Circuit to the U.S. Supreme Court, who just heard arguments a couple weeks ago. So we have, you know, we expect a decision on this one in 2024.
I was saying earlier, I noted the link here is interesting because 2 years ago, the California Supreme Court ruled that school board members, this would include charter schools, board members, use of their own personal email addresses and personal phones and text messaging to conduct school business was and are public records subject to the Public Records Act. So you could see, I would imagine you might see an expansion into that here, but we'll see.
All right, we're going to round out now our First Amendment cases. We have Chen versus Albany Unified School District, another Ninth Circuit decision that came down in 2022. So in this case, the Ninth Circuit upheld a California school district discipline of two high school students. And essentially what was going on is the students had an Instagram account. They were using that account off campus, but they were filling the account with racist imagery and comments targeting their Black classmates. The school disciplined them, and they sued alleging that their speech was off campus and was protected by the First Amendment and thus not subject to school discipline. As we have here, the court unanimously rejected the students' arguments and held that the school district was absolutely in its right to discipline, and so doing so did not violate any First Amendment freedoms. This case offers, I wanted to put this one in there because it offers an interesting juxtaposition to the California Supreme Court's 2021 decision in Mahanoy v. BL, which I know that Paul and I covered with you all last year. That also addressed school discipline of off-campus speech, but came to the opposite result. As you may recall, in Mahanoy, the school disciplined a student for her campus off-campus social media rant about cheerleading. She didn't make the team and she went home and was spewing profanities about the team and about the school. And the school disciplined her and she sued, and ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court determined that that discipline violated her First Amendment rights. However, the Mahanoy case did leave room for specifically incidents like this, where the off-campus speech was effectively bullying and harmful to others and other students' rights. And, you know, so that's the distinction that they drew here. You know, that Mahanoy didn't set this broad definition saying that any off-campus speech would not be subject to discipline. You know, it certainly could be the case where there's bullying and threatening harm, that discipline is warranted and needed. Okay.
I have a couple of questions, if you
yeah,
don't mind.
Thanks.
So should we as board members specifically be using the school email that we've been given and remove our personal and work emails because of all this? Because that's not been made super clear, and that sounds like it really is a good idea to never use our personal emails.
For school-related business, yes, all school-related business should run through.
But does that count, like, you know, board meeting notices and people sending me an agenda? Like, does that, you know, if they're sending me an agenda and it's being forwarded to my personal email, does that mean all of my personal email is now public record?
No, yeah, actually, the way this, I think this is a great clarifying question. What the court said was essentially is, A, board members and other public agency leads should be trained. B, if there was ever a Public Records Act request in there, it said, I want all public records, including records, blah, 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 that include text and emails with your board members. We would come to the board members and say, here are the keywords you need to look through. You, here's what you need to do to look through your email to find work-related emails on your private email, and then forward them. And you would essentially sign a declaration or affirmation saying, these are the only work-related emails.
I see. Okay, so
but
they don't
there
get
could be
access to
further
this, the whole
lawsuit.
thing.
Yeah, we haven't thankfully we haven't seen too many of those circumstances arise. But to eliminate that, if an organization just came and said, "I don't use my personal email for school related business, I only use the domain given to me," then you're done. You wouldn't even have to look.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then the second question is, it seems like there's no protections for board members among for, you know, when they're getting harassed by parents on social media. Clearly these parents are suing to, you know, be able to be as vocal and rude as they can be. Is there something that protects us? I mean, can't, you know, if somebody starts doing that to one of us, what can we do?
So it's a really tricky situation. We first start usually with the community standards of the social media app to try to see if they're violating community standards and have the app take it down.
Right.
If it is on the school's controlled assets, obviously these cases inform what we can do. If they cross the line into defamation and there's a standard for public agency protection, this is going to get to the state actors issue that we're going to talk about in a minute. Are board members of charter schools private board members or are they public board members? One California appellate court decision years ago concluded that an executive director of a charter school was akin to a school district superintendent, thus public. Therefore, they cannot win a defamation action against somebody unless instead of a reasonable, the standard being just beyond a preponderance of evidence, they have to show by clear and convincing evidence that the person knew what they were saying about the board member was false and casting a false light or disparaging their reputation, et cetera. So it's a very, very high bar as a public agency representative to sue for defamation. So it's very tricky. We send to cease and desist letters. Sometimes that works. Sometimes that just escalates the matter. It's always sort of very fact dependent. Can we sue? Can we use community standards? Can we cease and desist? Can you regulate? And then can you use, if it's controlled media, can you go ahead and regulate it through excluding these people from further commenting? So
Okay.
it's yeah, there's no, it's very, it can be very tricky.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Good question.
I think, Paul, you should mention director insurance during this part of the presentation.
Yeah, that is, again, is Mary,
That's
thank you. That's
funny. You didn't mention it this morning, and I was hoping you'd mention it.
It was earlier. He did mention that that was part of it.
Oh, did you? Okay, I missed
That's right.
that.
It's, if the situation were to arise where there was an incident like some of these, where the board member was, say, the board you controlled your social media account and you shut down the social media account and blocked somebody and you were sued, there's a high degree of likelihood that the directors and officers insurance that the school maintains would actually defend you in that action.
Got
In the
it.
case. So I think that's where Mary was trying to add an extra layer is even in these situations of constitutional claims and those sort of things, that there would be that extra layer of protection. And then one step further, even just Mary, to build on that, the board can indemnify other board members and officers against claims if there is no insurance. So there's just multiple layers of protections for the board members.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the important part. So it isn't just for liability, like if you get sued, we're able to take action for protection, I believe, which our boards would do anyway.
Understood. Thank you.
Hey, Kayla, you want to jump into the state actor issue?
Yes, let's talk about charter schools with state actors. Are they, aren't they? It's
It's
quite,
all the fun ones.
yeah, I know. It's quite a mess. So this Peltier versus charter day school decision came down from the Fourth Circuit. It tests whether a charter school is a state actor for purposes of student claims. That determination is incredibly important because if a charter school is a state actor, then they can be sued for violations of constitutional rights, as Paul mentioned briefly. This is because the 14th Amendment protects says that states cannot deny persons equal protection of the law. That's the Equal Protection Clause. But who is the state and what actors can be considered as acting on behalf of the state and thus subject to the dictates of the 14th Amendment is a question that kind of remains out there. So go to the next slide. This case involved a charter school in North Carolina. The school had a requirement that girls had to wear skirts to the school. And the mother of a female kindergarten student objected to that requirement, saying, My daughter is a young 5-year-old. She wants to be able to run, play, jump, and having to wear a skirt is hurting her ability to do so. To that objection, the school explained that the school emphasizes traditional values, quote, and enforces the code of conduct where girls are supposed to be treated if they are a, and this is a quote, a fragile vessel that men are supposed to take care of and honor, end quote. And that in an effort to preserve chivalry and respect among young men and women, in the school of choice, that was the decision that the school had made. The girl's parents and others brought an action against the charter school, arguing sex-based classification grounded on gender stereotypes, said that it violated the Equal Protection Clause. The Fourth Circuit had this 101-page opinion, very, very lively exchanges among the various justices, chivalry, gender stereotypes, just legal status of charter schools, most importantly for our purposes, all were discussed. Ultimately, the majority found that charter schools are state actors. And they said, really, it's not that complicated. First, the state here, North Carolina, is required under its constitution to provide K-12 education to its state residents. North Carolina has fulfilled this obligation by creating and funding the public charter school system. And North Carolina is exercising its sovereign prerogative in treating these schools, which are state created and state funded, as public institutions that perform a traditionally exclusive government function of educating the youth, operating the state's public schools. And that given all of that, it means that the charter schools in North Carolina are state actors. However, the inquiry is pretty complicated. The Fourth Circuit ruling here is seemingly inconsistent with Ninth Circuit authority. That has held that charter school operators are not state actors. That was based on an Arizona charter school, which claimed out of the Ninth Circuit that said that employees who were had filed claims were not state actors for purposes of those claims. And so that even though charter schools are defined as public schools by the state in that case, in Arizona, the Ninth Circuit said that that does not transform these private organizations, the nonprofit public benefit corporations operating charter schools, into government actors. And, in reaching that decision, the Ninth Circuit obviously looked at precedent and other things, but came to the opposite results that the Fourth Circuit did. I kind of expected the Supreme Court to hear this case. We have a circuit split. And there was a lot of press around the case. Ultimately, they declined to hear it, so that appellate ruling still stands. And it's precedent in that jurisdiction, which could subject charter schools to a broad range of claims, but also has some benefits too. Paul, if you want to touch on
Well, I
that.
was just going to say the National Charter School Association filed a letter brief to the Supreme Court arguing that the charter schools are state actors. They believe firmly that charter schools in California and elsewhere should be treated as state actors, subject to the constitutional prescriptions and proscriptions that you were talking about, Kayla, earlier, because if they're not state actors, then they could operate in direct contravention to, 150, 200-year history. First and 14th Amendment rights to protect liberty, justice, free speech, religion, all those things. And you could have religious-based charter schools, et cetera. So they see this as a big, big issue, and they don't want to ultimately see the U.S. Supreme Court determine that charter schools are not state actors for these purposes. But it won't be the last time that this comes to the U.S. Supreme Court's doorstep to be heard. So.
All right, we have just a quick update for you on some pending litigation. This is the Green Dot versus CalSTRS case. So, just as some background, there have been some nonprofit corporations that operate multiple charter schools where CalSTRS has come in and said that individual employees or retirees who were working at the nonprofit corporation or the home office level, it's just a inartful term for they weren't working for just one school. They hadn't been exclusively assigned to one school. That because of that, those employees, those retirees did not work for an employer for purposes of the education code and therefore did not perform a creditable service and therefore should not have been in CalSTRS. And then, you know, therefore tried to kick them out and reduce their pension payments, et cetera. So a lawsuit has been filed in that. Just wanted to give everybody a very short heads up.
The CalSTRS decision in that regard has or could have a very, very profound effect on many, many nonprofit administrators working in multi-charter. It affects any single nonprofit operating multiple charter schools in the state of California, which there are many.
Yep.
That would affect specifically Tim and myself.
Yep.
Which will, you know, we will discuss at another time. PERS at this point are not potentially affected. However, the reality is that we know if STRS goes that way, PERS could. We don't know. Thank you.
So a few new laws regarding employees. This legislative session, we saw just a ton of new laws. We're giving you just a few here today, along with the critical case updates. But these are some in the employee context. The first is SB 497. And what this does is it creates a rebuttable presumption in favor of an employee, so very employee-driven, claim of discrimination or retaliation if an employer engages in any discriminatory or retaliatory action within 90 days of whatever protected activity is specified. And there can be serious consequences, financial consequences for this. A corporation or LLC is subject to a civil penalty of up to $10,000 per employee for each violation. So, you know, we're a very employee-friendly state, and this legislation really ramps that up. Also, can't
more law. We're just going to see a whole bunch more threats and lawsuits. We're going to have disgruntled employees submitting, you know, claims every 90 days just to stay protected under this provision of the law. It's
not well thought out at all. Yeah. SB 700, cannabis discrimination, also makes it unlawful for an employer to seek information regarding a applicant's prior use of cannabis. However, if you obtain that information from their criminal history, you're exempt from that unless there's another specified provision. But the bigger rule is just makes it unlawful generally for an employer to request information about cannabis use. And then there's also a new provision regarding paid leave. Employers have to provide 5 days or 40 hours of sick leave per year. But note for you all here, all the school already far exceeds this requirement. There's also SB 848, which provides leave for reproductive loss. So essentially it requires an employer to grant 5 days of leave following reproductive loss. Requires that the leave be taken within 3 months of that loss. And if the employee experiences this more than one time within 12 months, so 1 year, the employer does not have to give more than 20 days within that year period. And another important point is that that leave may be unpaid. Okay, PAGA claim arbitration. The issue here was whether PAGA, the Private Attorney General Act, claims are subject to individual arbitration in California. So what happened in this case was there was a former employee who filed a PAGA action against her employer in California state court. She was seeking civil penalties. She was claiming that her employer had failed to provide her with final wages within the time frame required by the California Labor Code. But in addition to her own individual complaints, she also asserted a wide array of other labor code violations, minimum wage, overtime, meal periods, rest periods, pay stubs, timing of pay, allegedly that was sustained by other employees. The employer then moved to compel arbitration of the former employee's individual PAGA claims, so not that greater, bigger one, just the individual one. And the Supreme Court reversed. The U.S. Supreme Court reversed the California Supreme Court, which held that the former rule that an individual PAGA claim is not divisible from that representative PAGA claim, that big group that she was also trying to bring in, is incompatible with the Federal Arbitration Act. So what that means is that employers should look at their arbitration agreements, look at their employment agreements in their arbitration clauses therein, work with counsel, craft those agreements to include in their scope the individual PAGA claims being subject to arbitration, as well as provisions that prevent those agreements from being interpreted as wholesale waivers of representative PAGA claims, the greater ones where she tried to bring in all these others. It's a minefield. It's pretty complicated. It also left a lot of questions open. So, you know, seek the advice of counsel. Okay, we have a few new laws on student matters. This is something we've seen come up actually for the past couple of legislative sessions. It's what you can and can't, why you can and cannot suspend a student. So this one prohibits high school students from being suspended for willful defiance, but it does retain a teacher's authority to suspend a student from their class, essentially. So what that means is those students can't be suspended, can't have an off-campus suspension for willful defiance. They can have an on-campus suspension and be prohibited from a specific teacher's class for conduct. We also got some expansions of student excused absences. We, of course, in attendance have both excused and unexcused absences. So we got an expansion of what excused means. The currently for funeral and support, students could have 1 day excused absence for an in-state funeral and 3 days for out-of-state. This now increases the number of days a student must be excused to attend a funeral or to grieve the death of a family member to 5 days. And then it requires a student to be excused for not more than 3 days for the purpose of grief support services, effectively, if the person who died was a member of the student's immediate family. We also got an expansion for excused absences in religious retreats. Previously, students could be had to be excused for 4 hours per semester. This expands it to a whole school day. So it used to be effectively a half school day, a little more than half, and now it is a full school day. Curriculum. All right, we are rounding out our discussion here. This is the last new law that we are going to cover, AB 1078, Diversity in Curriculum. This was an urgency statute, meaning that it took place immediately. So it came into law on September 25th, 2023. So this is currently the law. It requires schools, when adopting instructional materials, to include materials that consider the all genders and the role of Latino Americans, LGBTQ plus Americans, other ethnic, religious, and socioeconomic status groups. So that's the adoption of new materials, not a revision required to current materials, but when new materials are added, they must include those. And then if we go to the next slide, this is just so existing law, we have the Safe Place to Learn Act. And essentially what that does is it requires the CDE to assess whether schools have a policy that prohibits discrimination, harassment, and bullying. Now it's expanded out with 1078. So it requires that a policy to not only prohibit discrimination, harassment, and bullying, but to apply that statement to all acts of the governing body or body of the school, not just the school or the students itself. It expands that out to the board members as well. And then it additionally requires the CDE to develop guidance and public education materials that meet the additional requirements that 1078 covers about the Latino community, the LGBTQ plus community, various genders, et cetera. So it requires the CDE to do some work and develop some materials that schools can use to meet those purposes.
Are those both specifically California laws? Is that right?
They are, yes.
Okay.
All right. With that, we are at the question stage.
Any questions or comments about that information? I want to apologize to you all about how all these high-level and fully charged political and legal issues are playing out in public schools, more so than I, honestly, I've been at this for 30 years. It's, I can't remember a time when there have been so many polarizing issues going on in public schools and playing out in the courtrooms all at the same time. So it's, I know it's a lot to stay on top of and probably a lot to manage as well.
Yes, that seems to be happening everywhere at this point. Yeah. Lots of these polarizing issues being, you know, people figuring out the right platform that they can get their voices heard and then making it happen. I don't have any further questions. I've asked mine as I've gone along the way. Chris or Jim, do you have any questions?
No, obviously a lot of information there. I think Wayland, yours was a poignant one about the school email address and considering that piece of it. And I mean, I guess, are there any of these, maybe Mary or anybody else that you would highlight that we would pay? They're all important, obviously, but that are maybe to zone in on or focus on as any matter or anything that you're seeing at Altus.
Or that could affect us, yeah, soon.
Well, everything is important. we monitor all of it and try diligently to stay compliant. Much of it is a non-problem for us because we do it anyway. So certainly one of the issues that we're facing is STIRS retirement for our senior leaders, actually. I don't think it's a problem for staff, for instructional staff. It's the senior leaders that are an issue, which is Tim and myself, mm-hmm. not PERS. So that, but we'll discuss that at another date. You know, that's probably urgent in the world of legislation and law, which is slow. So it's a slow urgency. Let's put it that way. It's very important, but it has to evolve. And we are, as always, looking at some proactive strategies, which, again, we'll discuss with you at another time. But we're not concerned for staff as a whole. It's the leadership. And we're not really worried because we know our boards are very cognizant of taking care of our senior leaders. Other than that, it's aggravating that we... For a lot of people, it was a relief that we were not, that we were extended. For us, it was a little annoying because we were prepared, ready to go. We've got a strategic plan and all that. But, you know, you just kind of go with it. I would, though, like to thank Wayland, if I could. Some of the staff is going through this a second time today, which is, it's very entertaining and all. Thank you so much for being here. I wanted them available in case you had specific questions relating to their departments and what they're doing.
Thank you all for that. Yeah, that's a sacrifice. I do have one other comment, or at least question, maybe comment. I'm not sure, but it seems like there are a lot of legislators really out to get charter schools. And are there any that are supportive? I mean, what are we involved with in trying to help promote the benefit that we bring, because we bring a big benefit that public schools aren't, and it seems like we're always under fire. Is that is there a good place to research that, or are there resources I should look into to kind of learn more about the people who are doing things to support charter schools?
Mary, do you want to respond? I know you have a lobbyist, and yeah.
No, I don't have a lobbyist anymore.
Oh, okay.
For a variety of reasons, but it's it's hard to make an impact. Let's put it that way. No is the answer. I'm sure there's people that are supportive, and yet they used to be much more visible and public. And I couldn't count on my hand the number of people that are out there really advocating for charter schools.
Yeah, it must be a fall in the money question.
There are some, you know, but it falls on deaf ears. I mean, we've got a whole system in California that is not that is tied to the traditional, let's put it that way, traditional in the sense of the status quo. So you know, you don't get popular by doing that, and so thus anyone who has a feeling for parent voice and equity in terms of how different types of educational delivery systems are supported.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's unless there's a real different sweep of the conventional thinking of legislators and or politicians and or school board associations and districts, and unless there's a real change, bellwether change, I can expect that over the next few years, we can anticipate more. And the way we combat it is by doing good things for kids. Success is the best, I don't like to use the word weapon, but the best defense.
Yeah. I mean, it's the data. If people would only look at the data, you know, I just wish that was more of that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that doesn't always do it either. So we just continue. And so that's why we're so grateful, board members, that you are so valiant and such advocates and give us that quiet support that we need and the advice and, you know, the oversight. I mean, you're so good, you know, about calling, what about this, what about that? We encourage that and we're so grateful for it because you have your expertise and you share it with us and we need it. Jim, you have such much expertise, and Chris, Waylon, each one of you. I mean, you're such pros. And
well, we see something of great value here, Mary, that you all are contributing to our society mm-hmm. and our children. And I just wish a broader audience could see that more and more, because it really is, it's worth it. And we're doing good work here. So thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And you know, it is ironical because we believe our model is the model of the future. I mean, look at our post-secondary institutions more and more. Pick up the paper. I mean, what we're doing is futuristic. And we may find in a few years that education, public education as a whole, is even more impacted by our design and our successes. And so that's
what one we can keep. Hope. One can hope.
Thank you.
All right. Any other thoughts right now? Or should we move to section 4, board comments and announcements? If we can move there. All right. From time to time, the board has topics of interest they'd like to share with the community. These are informational in nature and do not require action. Just as a reminder, one thing is we do have a regular board meeting on Thursday, December 7th. And I believe that's being considered to be moved to 2:30 p.m.
Yes.
There's an email that went out that we need to get people's responses on.
Yes. Would you be available at 2:30 instead of 1 o'clock, board members? Young Mini and CORE is scheduled to meet with you, and they have a prior commitment, and that just came up, I guess. And so
that works for me. Chris,
can you? I see Jim nodding his head. How about you, Chris?
I wrote Len. Unfortunately, it does not. Although I might be able to change some things around, and so we're going to see if Christina is free.
Let us know then. Thank you so much for your consideration, because it's important that he talk to you. Thank you both, Kenny and Corey. You're a great team.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. You guys did a great job. Any other comments from board members or anyone? Okay. All right, moving to section 5, adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
Chris Gordon, motion to adjourn.
All right. All those, could I have a second for that? Sorry.
Jim Herr, I second that motion.
All right. All those in favor say aye, no, or abstain. Chris Gordon, your vote?
Chris Gordon, aye.
Jim Herr?
Jim Herr, aye.
And Waylon Myers votes aye. And that's it. Hope you all have a great week.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks for all the work put in. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.